Access number 12551, Reel 4.
Colonel Waldridge, Reel 4. Any resentment from the German population at your army activities, or had they just become used to it?
I think they accepted it. There were always rumblings, not surprisingly, about cutting down on the use of Soul Town, the damage our tracked vehicles did. But it was no longer anything like Austria, to which I've already referred, where you could go anywhere and do anything. If you did do damage in Germany, then it was the owners were recompensed. However, the aim was not to do damage. And so we were confined really to training areas, except the fact we had to drive to them on the roads, which can't have been very popular. And they concentrated on trying to cut down the number of training areas. But, as I say, it was a completely different concept of soldiering to me at that time.
Did you have much contact with the Germans?
Yes. For example, our house was on a German estate, but not a lot. I think people felt that Minden was not a good place because there had been trouble years before with the Cameronians when they'd broken the place up and there'd been some ill feeling. And my feeling was that people in Minden were a bit wary, I think is the word I'd use, of having anything to do with the British. I certainly felt later on, when I went further south in Germany and indeed to Berlin a couple of times, that they were far more friendly in other parts of Germany. I wouldn't have said Minden struck me as being a friendly part of Germany. But they were not unfriendly. They weren't unpleasant at all.
Did anybody ever mention the Cameronians to you?
Only the British. No, the Germans never did.
As you pointed out to me off the record, you did have a year at the Staff College at Camberley in 61. Can you tell me what you thought of that course?
Yes, of course, it was a great thing to have been selected, great milestone in one's career. It was a marvellous rounding off again. And I mean, everybody ought to do it, not just a few selected few. I suppose the facilities don't exist to do it for everybody. It was very interesting to see the attitude of the directing staff, most of whom still had very high-grade war experience and who were specially selected themselves. And we learnt so much from them. It was a lot of written work, as well as practical work. I had one instructor in particular who made a tremendous impact on me. And this was, at that time, Lieutenant Colonel David Scott Barrett, who's now General Retired David Scott Barrett, Sir David Scott Barrett. The first thing I'd say about him was that I put in some written work to him, and he repeated what I'd heard, I suppose, many times before. It is quite pointless you putting this written work in. You will have to type everything in future because no one otherwise will read it. Learn to type. Sadly, I had to go to him and say to him, Colonel, I'm sure these remarks are jolly well meant and extremely useful, but what do they actually say? Because I can't read them. Anyway, he roared with laughter, explained, and I learned to type. And I've always typed ever since. And he was quite right. And the other abiding memory was doing one of these tactical exercises without troops, which the Staff College so enjoyed doing, up at on the Thames at Henley, the river crossing. And David Scott Barrett was my DS, and the directing staff generally were more frightened of the colonel's GS than they were of than we were of them. And so he walked us miles over hills and hedges, trying to get us away from anybody else. And he said, you don't want to talk about all this silly old stuff here. He said, I'll tell you what happens in war. And he told us what happened in war. And suddenly, over the wall, climbed one of the colonel's GS, at which, without turning a hair, he changed and said, well, as we were just discussing in problem 3, the movement of tanks over this country here is particularly difficult. And the Colonel G.S. nodded sagely and passed on. And then David Scott Barrett then relaxed and returned to telling what, in fact, I think were far more valuable war stories, such as, remember, he said, that when you're planning the movement of all the ammunition and everything else, which is what we were being trained to do, he said, what you've got to remember is Guardsman Snodgrass in his size 10 boots falling out of his APC in the middle of the night in a muddy field. And how right he was. There are so many administrators who don't remember the guy who's at the right at the bottom end of this thing. And he had another great phrase. And he said, just you remember this. Big fingers, little maps, kills lots of chaps. And I've never forgotten these things. And I was fortunate enough years later to serve him when he was the commandant in Berlin as one of his staff officers. And he's a great man. He's still alive. He was known right through the army as Wobbly Scott Barrett, but by gosh, he was a great, great leader.
So he was talking about the necessity for large-scale maps.
Yes, don't just point on a map and say, we'll go round there. Just go and look at the bloody ground and see what you're going round first. I relate to the guy who's going to have to do all these things that you eggheads are planning. It isn't just as simple as that. There's a lot to it. Anyway, that year at Staff College, you had a different syndicate leader. You had about four different ones, I think, or five. And one learned, you know, from each of them different things. But he was the one who had most impact on me, there's no doubt about it. And then at the end of that, we were all told what our jobs were going to be, and I became a G2 training at Shorncliffe, where I worked for a general called Grimshaw, who'd been an Inniskilling and served in the Indian Army. And my main claim to fame, I think, at Shorncliffe was that I learnt to play golf and was taught to play golf by two very good staff officers.
If I could jump ahead again to the times you were in Berlin.
Yes.
What kind of duties did you have in Berlin? Because you were with the Fusiliers at this time, I think.
Yes, the first time I went to Berlin, and I'm very lucky to have served there twice at a happy time. I commanded the 1st Battalion Royal Warwicks, and the 2nd Battalion, the Royal Regiment of Fusiliers. I was the CO, and we occupied Brook Barracks. We were affiliated to Charlottenburg Bezirk, the district. There were three battalions in Berlin at the time. We had to do all sorts of ceremonial duties, participating in the Berlin Tattoo, guards, honour guards, carry the baggage for the RAF Staff College when it arrived at Gatow Airport, indeed. Every infantry battalion had to be prepared, and we'd been warned of this, to put up with almost anything in Berlin because there were so many compensations. And there were. We lived very well. We had a good esprit de corps. The Germans wanted us there, as they did the Americans and the French. We had affiliations with the American army and with the French army, as well as the German Bezirks. And the Germans wanted us there, we wanted to be there, we all thoroughly enjoyed it, and we did things together, and we took a pride in doing everything well. It was a joy and a pleasure to be there. You have the best of everything, or had the best of everything in Berlin, from the top performers. I saw the Bolshoi Ballet there, I saw Ella Fitzgerald there, I saw Benny Goodman there. I saw countless operas. Everything was there. And it was a show place. It really was a fascinating place to be. It may not have been quite so good for the soldiers, who perhaps hadn't got the wide horizons that I'd acquired, because I was older than they were. But I hope we encouraged them, and there were educational facilities to learn German and do everything. One of the high points, in my view, of my military career was when we beat the retreat at the Charlottenburg Schloss, which is a lovely building in Berlin, which was our affiliated Bezirk, as I've said, and where I was required to make a speech, which I did in German. I memorised it. I had it on a piece of paper in my pocket, as is my wont, but I memorised it all, and I can speak German reasonably. And as I say, I think that was the high spot of my career. The Germans actually understood it and laughed at the right times. And whereas General Scott Barrett, to whom I've already referred, was the commandant and valiantly tried to speak German, or rather read German, he had no idea how to pronounce it. Whereas I could pronounce it quite well. I'm not saying that we were competitors, we weren't. And as I say, I got on extremely well with him, but I was complimented by a member of the, no less than the British Foreign Service, of whom there were many in Berlin, on at least showing willing and trying to speak German. So that was a good thing. And we did have very, very good relationships with everybody there. In fact, just before the battalion were due to move from Berlin, we used to... Sorry to diverge slightly. We used to run the roulette in the officers' club. We took it over from our predecessors, the Gloucestershire Regiment, and we ran the roulette as a business. And during one of our roulette Saturday evening sessions, the phone rang. I was summoned to the phone, and the duty officer said, "Colonel, the battalion baggage store is on fire." "You're joking, David," I said. "I'm not, Colonel." So he was quite right. So we, the fire brigade and us, and generally, set about this. And quite a lot of damage was done, and quite a lot of people lost a lot of their baggage. The very next morning, which was a Sunday, the Bürgermeister of Charlottenburg came to see me. And he said, "Colonel, I'm so sorry to hear this. Can you tell me what, in effect, has happened?" And I told him, and I told him how people had lost their equipment and all sorts of things, their clothing. Some people have got all their baggage in. I, in fact, myself, was not going with the battalion. I was going a different way. And so my baggage wasn't in, thank goodness. Anyway, I told him all this. And Monday morning, he arrived with a check. I said, "Colonel, I'd like you to spend this on helping the most needy of your soldiers." A very generous check. I can't remember what it was. I think it was the equivalent of £10,000. To refurbish and help them get back some of the things they'd lost. I know it can't replace the sentimental value, but here it is. And I was really lost for words. It was so generous. And people were so kind. It was a marvellous place to be, Berlin. Anyway, that tour came to an end, and off I set for Northern Ireland.
Did you go into East Berlin?
Yes. Oh, yes. We had to, of course, stick to all the rules and book in and out and go to the checkpoint. We used to go to the East Berlin Opera, and we went on a tour of East Berlin to Treptow Park, where the Russian memorial was, which I think the East Germans resented, or it would seem that they did, as much as anybody could have resented anything. You couldn't really go across informally very much. It would perhaps be unwise to have done so. But we knew quite well the British ambassador to East Berlin, who later became British ambassador in Moscow, Sir Curtis Keeble, because our daughters were of an age, and so we got to know him. And we went to his house in East Berlin occasionally. It wasn't an atmosphere you would wish to go. It was just a sort of curiosity value to go and see what it was like, although the opera was good. But it was so much easier to go to the opera in the West, which was just as good, but not in a classical opera house. It was in a modern opera house in West Berlin, where no matter where you sat, you could hear and see everything, whereas you might get a pillar in the East Berlin in front of you. But in both cases, the quality of the opera was marvellous, as it is almost right through Germany. So that we came to the end of that tour.
If I could just ask you about the Russians.
Sorry, yes.
About the Red Army.
Yes.
About your relationship.
That's true. Well, the main contact I had with them was at Spandau Prison, which was adjacent to our barracks in West Berlin, where, of course, at that time we were all guarding Hess. And periodically there would be a commandant's lunch in the prison to which I would go. And we'd meet the Russians who were allowed to get there, the Red Army and sometimes Red Air Force people, who all spoke perfect Americanized English and were very clever people and seemed very reasonable, and you didn't talk politics at all, really. But other than that, and seeing the Red Army patrol outside the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in East Berlin, I didn't really have much contact with them. I was reprimanded on one occasion, I recall, in that all the embassies and missions in Berlin would throw their parties at their various times, and the Yugoslavian attaché threw a marvellous party. I mean, there was never seen such food and drink in such quantity. And I found he was quite a nice chap, and we asked him back to my house for a meal with others, a dinner party. And I was rung up a few days later by someone in the special branch, or whatever it was called. I understand you've had Colonel, whatever his name was, I can't remember it now, into your house. And I said, yes, I thought he was a very nice chap. I think we must warn you that you'd be well advised not to do that again. So I didn't do it again. And what's happened to him now, I really don't know. But you did meet an amazing cross-section of
What did they mean by that, exactly?
Sorry?
What did they mean by that?
I think they thought that he would try to suborn me, I don't know. Perhaps whether... I really have no idea. The implication was that he was up to no good, and he was pleasant because he was trying to worm his way into our organisation or try and get information from us. I don't know. But I certainly felt I'd been warned off, and I took the hint.
What conditions has been kept under? Were they reasonable?
Would what have been kept under? Sorry.
Yes, Rudolf.
Oh, yes, poor old guy. He had a cell and a bed and his daily newspapers, and he exercised in round the yard, and he could have visitors. Periodically he was taken ill while I was there, so we transferred the guard down to the hospital and he was cared for in the hospital. I never talked to him or had communication with him. I've seen him, but I hadn't communicated with him. And I don't know how alert his brain was, but he must have felt very, very circumscribed and confined for all those years. Must have been dreadful. There was I think we would have been more generous, but I don't think the Russians were prepared to forgive him.
How close to him did you get?
About 5 yards, I suppose. But
what did his demeanour seem to be?
Well, he shuffled around. I suppose very neutral sort of demeanour. He didn't proudly stand up and look at you haughtily. On the other hand, he didn't shuffle away without looking at you. He just ignored you, or he just ignored me anyway, really, I think.
So he didn't speak to you?
No words passed between us.
You were just about to go off to Northern Ireland in 1971 when
yes.
I interrupted you.
Yes, that's right. We'd had a visit from the chief of the general staff in Berlin, and he said, had I got any complaints? And I said, well, not really, General. In fact, it was Mike Carver, who was not noted for his kindness of heart. Not really, General, but I've only got 2 months left to do in command, and I haven't been told where I'm going yet. But he soon put that right. And within a week or so, I was told I was going to Northern Ireland as the AAG, Assistant Adjutant General, and Assistant Military Secretary. So off we zoomed to Northern Ireland on the staff at HQ Northern Ireland District at Lisburn, County Antrim. And we arrived almost simultaneously with the furore over internment, which had just been launched. And I had really a most interesting job, I suppose, there. I was the A staff officer, which meant morale, discipline, and so on, and the assistant military secretary. Well, the discipline side meant I had to work closely with the military police, and therefore the special investigation branch, and all this malarkey of these patrols that used to go out. Can't remember what they were, the Mobile Reaction Force they were called. trying to catch the IRA at their own game. And combined with that, as the Assistant Military Secretary who deals with promotions and awards, I had to process all the citations for various decorations and things. And of course I was involved in instructions to soldiers that were issued on the, can't remember what colour card it was in Ireland. It used to be a yellow card, an orange card in Cyprus, I think, a green card somewhere else. Anyway, the card that tells a soldier when he may and may not open fire. And I was involved in all these things.
What did you think about the restrictions which were placed on them in that respect?
They're right, because you can't uphold the law unless you observe the law. On the other hand, you can't expect someone who thinks he's going to be shot at, but doesn't know for sure that he's going to be shot at, not to loose off a round if he thinks he sees someone with a rifle or with a weapon. And it's bloody difficult. Youngsters were shot because they'd got a stick, I remember, in one hand. They were hiding behind a wall with a little stick. And I know a soldier shot one of these. Thought he'd been shot at just beforehand, and he thought that's where it had come from, so he shot, and it was a small boy. And you always get this, and it's dreadful. But you've got to observe the law. But it should be tempered with understanding when people just... It's so easy to be wise after the event and say, well, you shouldn't have shot. And, of course, someone who looses off 10 rounds after they've had one shot fired at them, there's no excuse for that. They must fire, as you always train to fire, you fire one aimed shot. You don't loose off rounds and fire mortar bombs in the general direction of people. You've got to know what you're doing. But there are bound to be mistakes, and people are bound, understandably, to not be sure whether they're going to be killed or not. And they're there trying to... After all, we were invited in to protect the Catholics in Londonderry in 68-ish. And that's what we tried to do. And there's been a lot wrong with Ireland and so on. And internment, I still don't know. I regret to say the police are now under more and more suspicion for the way they've behaved and been found to be dishonest in order to obtain convictions. But certainly in Ireland, they will swear they know that O'Hara or O'Higgins or whatever he is, they know he's a member of the IRA. And they can't get the evidence because people are frightened to give it because they'll be shot if they do. And so that, I suppose that's the argument for internment. But it can be abused. And I really don't know. I remember someone saying, if I was God, I wouldn't know what to do to solve the Irish problem. And I'm blamed if I know.
How much danger did you feel yourself to be in there?
Not a lot, really. Perhaps I should have felt it more. I lived out on a civilian housing estate, as we could do then. But I used to and walk to work. I was quite near. But Lisbon was a Protestant area. But I would always take a weapon, carry a Browning pistol in my pocket when I went with the magazine full, when I went to and from work. On the other hand, I've always been a great jogger all my life. I used to go off jogging at weekends, round country lanes. I never went the same way twice if I could avoid it. And I always was thinking as I jogged, well, now, if someone comes out from there, which way am I going? Well, that's not the ideal way to relax. But the only incident in which I and my family were involved in the Lisbon area was when my daughters came home from school in England for a holiday. And incidentally, whereas in Berlin all their friends had flocked to come out and spend a holiday with us, we didn't get one come to Ireland with them. However, my wife went to have her hair done in Lisbon with my two daughters and said, right, girls, you may go shopping and then you're to come straight back here. Came the end of the hair session with the hair, and there was a bomb scare in Lisbon. And daughters were one side of where the bomb was, and my wife was the other. And you can imagine the pantomime. Fortunately, there was no bomb. And at the end of the day, they all met up again. But that scared them. But that was the nearest we came, happily, to anything unpleasant. We used to go out to Irish families at night. And no Irish party, so far as I can see, even if you're asked for 8 o'clock, starts at about midnight. And we'd enjoy it, and they were always so hospitable. When I first went there, when visitors came out, we would take them and we'd drive them down the Falls Road. Well, that was perhaps foolhardy. In fact, it wasn't too foolhardy in those days, but it got worse. We would go out into the Ards Peninsula area or down to County Down, Newcastle County Down. No trouble at all, as we'd be when we'd been there before. But you never quite knew, and it was much tauter and much more unpleasant. And of course, while we were there, we had the dreadful Londonderry business with the parachute regiment shooting 13 of the... they said they were the terrorists, and the Irish say they weren't. But it's easy to be wise afterwards. Yes, it was unpleasant, and it must be dreadful to be a Northern Irishman.
But you weren't in Londonderry yourself at that time?
No, I wasn't. No, part of my job was to go round and visit with visitors, generals and people, take them round the province. And I mean, I often went to Londonderry, and I went all over the place, went to Armagh and dreadful Coal Island. And
why dreadful?
It's just an area I would never feel safe in. it's a mixed area, but I didn't know it well, so I'm being biased. But and the awful border town, whose name I can't remember, where so many
castles.
Yes, that's it.
What was the attitude of the soldiers themselves towards serving there in 71, 73?
I think they knew they got a job to do, and they got on and did it. I don't think they liked going to Northern Ireland, actually, much, because you couldn't actually see the enemy and know who he was, and that's never good. You never know when you're going to be shot in the back. And that's not too encouraging for anybody. I've rarely seen a British soldier miserable there. The only time I have was when a soldier of mine was killed in a traffic accident on an exercise in Germany. And then the whole company almost burst into tears. I've never seen anything like it. But other than that, adversity as such seems to bring out the best in them. And they try and obey the rules. And they're great guys to lead.
Did any of the Irish speak to you about your presence as British military?
Well, yes, because one really, I realise now, only met the Protestants. I suppose almost from choice, in a way, in that we lived in Protestant areas and they were prepared to come and see us. I don't think Catholics probably were. Not because they didn't want to, perhaps maybe they were scared of what might happen to them. And although I don't go for the extremists on either side,